And if I may briefly correct, Your Honor, it's Bouchard.
I'm sorry. Thank you.
That's quite all right. It's one of those silly French names.
Okay, I see. Well, if there's any way to get it wrong, I'm sure I would. But that's a very nice name. Would you like to reserve some rebuttal time?
I would, please. Thank you.
How much?
I believe, if I'm correct in reading the email, we have a total of 15 minutes. I'd like to reserve 5 for rebuttal,
certainly,
if it pleases the court. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Julian Bouchard. I have the pleasure of representing Jameer Jordan in this appeal. The main issue in this case, as I see it and my client sees it, is the application of the doctrine of principle in the second degree to my client, given this set of facts. Briefly, my client was found guilty, as a matter of fact, by Judge Farmer in Suffolk of throwing an initial punch which preceded a large group of people then assaulting the victim as he fell to the ground with further kicks and punches.
Well, that isn't exactly the evidence. You correct me if I'm wrong.
Please.
He did throw the first punch with a closed fist. The victim fell to the ground, and a group began to stomp and kick him. And then there was a witness. It was testimony that as he fell to the ground, the defendant kept punching him. Then the friends jumped in and continued the stomping, and that he continued to be involved in that attack. Is any of that statement false?
It is, Judge, and it was negated on cross. If I may reference you to the transcript, and this I referenced in my brief, page 79.
Tell me what was false.
The fact that he continued punching the victim or kicking as he fell. That witness was Shakira Harrison, and on page 78, 79 of the transcript, starting on line 24, the question is, after Jameer punches, Jameer being the defendant, punches Jason being the victim, and he goes down, is it your testimony the group sweeps in, and then you can't tell if he's part of it, if Jameer is part of the group at this point? Isn't that what you just testified? Yes, but at that point I went in the house. My mom saw that it was getting too, aggressive. So after the punch, meaning the first punch, you lose all sight of what's going on as far as who's doing what. Is that correct? I went in the house. Yes. When pressed on cross-examination, this witness recanted her statement that my client, Jameer Jordan, began continuing punching the victim.
Doesn't the mother of the victim come out and indicate that there is contact that she sees with the appellant and the victim?
No. She says that she came out and began pulling. In her perspective, we have the victim on the ground, and there's a group around him. That she sees a group of people, and at this point, Your Honor, the mob around the attacking group is about 30, 40 people by the testimony.
Right.
So we have
she walks in to try to.
She does.
Lodge him out of there, and she falls on the ground. But doesn't she testify that the appellant is actually on top of the victim at that time?
She does not. What she testifies that he is in the group, yes, that is physically around, but as to actually striking the victim, she cannot tell. She can identify that Jameer Jordan was part of the group around, but as to actual punches and kicks, she's not specific on that point. And that's significant. Now, she has, after she falls, in fact, she grabs some people, and I think, and if I'm not mistaken, Jameer Jordan testified, he does put himself physically. He has no problem admitting that he was physically in that group because he was attempting, by his own testimony, trying to pull people off. And as a matter of fact, Miss Clay, the mother of the victim, did grab Jameer as one of the people that she was pulling off of the group. But you have to understand, this was a group of people tightly clustered, pretty much arm locked, assaulting the victim. So as far as her vantage point, she's coming from behind. So being able to distinguish who's throwing punches and kicks, I do not think is credible. And
well,
she did not specifically.
Isn't that the fact finder's decision and not an appellate court's?
It is, Your Honor. But her own testimony is not that she did not testify that she saw specific punches and kicks by that witness. She said that he was in the group, and we don't deny that. And so that's a significant factor.
Didn't she, and correct me if I'm wrong,
sure,
that she saw 15 boys on top of the victim, one of whom was the defendant, stomping and kicking him?
Okay. The fact of the matter is that
Was that her statement or not? Am I wrong on that?
If Judge, I'm going to take your word on that if you're reading from the transcript, obviously. Taken as a whole, her testimony, and again, if I may be given a brief moment. On page 66, with this crowd, again, on cross, because a witness's testimony must be taken as a whole. One cannot simply look at direct testimony while they're being guided by the attorney questioning them. I think that's highly inappropriate. We have to look at both the cross, because in cross-examination, we can separate the wheat from the chaff of a witness. With this crowd of people, they were surrounding your son, but you did not see the faces of the people that you were grabbing and pulling off. Is that correct? Correct. And we're talking about a pile of bodies here. Is that correct? Yes, sir. The point is that that cast a doubt as to what exactly, who was throwing what. Her vantage point, from the perspective of if Jameer Jordan was involved in punching and kicking, or if he's trying to pull people off, her perspective would be identical, because she's coming from behind. Now, there is the testimony that I need to overcome, and I'll freely admit that when she falls to the ground after pulling people off and breaks her arm, that she sees a group of kids high-fiving and places the defendant among them. I have to overcome that. There's no way to challenge that.
Didn't
she said that.
I don't know that it was the defendant, but one of the boys said, "Hey, we beat the tattooed man's ass."
Right, and I don't believe that she says that was my client. She says that was one of the boys.
I don't know. I don't think anybody identified who made that statement.
Correct.
That was during the time that they were high-fiving
each other. And I would submit that you have a victim. You have a victim's. I would not, and I do, I think it's an error. I think it's inappropriate for the fact finder to place that identification as beyond scrutiny. The fact of the matter is you have a lady who sees a group of people viciously assaulting her son. Adrenaline is up. She pulls people off of her son. She falls, breaks her arm. You now have an issue of pain she sees. And if I may, you have a group of kids all ranging between 17 and 19 years old, all black.
But how does that make her testimony inherently incredible? Account?
It doesn't make it inherently incredible. It makes it suspect. It doesn't make it above scrutiny.
But suspect's not the standard that we look at.
I just mean it's not above scrutiny. The fact of the matter is it does raise a doubt as far as, and here's why, specifically.
But counsel,
yes,
I think you're going down the wrong road in that what we have to look at once the fact finder, which was the judge who heard the case, the standard is abuse of discretion. That's what you have to show us,
ma'am,
in order for us to be able to embrace any of the facts that you're pointing out. So that's where you need to concentrate regarding that. Can you show us where that the judge abused his discretion?
Applying that identification was abuse of discretion for the following reason. There were several errors in Ms. Clay's identification of Jameer Jordan at trial. There was sufficient testimony by multiple witnesses specifically about his hair and how it was and the person who delivered the initial punch. This is a point that Judge Farmer, unfortunately, completely negated when he applied the identification she made. She identified the defendant, and I specifically asked on cross, how was his hairstyle that day? If you can identify him, if you're saying that the defendant sitting in that chair made those high fives, she said his hair was exactly the same as it was on the day of trial, which was done down in long corn rolls, which I believe is in the record. Every other single witness for the prosecution identified his hair in a big bushy ponytail. That one thing, that one fact, brings into doubt the fact that that person, the defendant, was part of that crowd. The reason why this is relevant is because the issue and principle in the second degree is concert of action. To show concert of action, one may not simply look at, was there a crime? Did it have multiple parts? Did multiple people participate in those parts? And does that all together, after the fact, put them together? You have to look at the beginning of the sequence of events and the actions of all participants leading up to the beginning of the crime, initiation of the crime. And I think it's telling
Counsel, help me,
yes,
if you would please. where in the trial does the judge denote that he is applying the doctrine of principal and second degree?
Yes, ma'am, for several reasons.
Well, yes, I understand where we are, but when does he articulate that that's what he's doing?
I'm looking in the appendix. The first piece of evidence that he articulates that I will concede, Judge Farmer does not say verbatim, I'm applying the principle of the second degree and that is why. But he does use the word concert of action immediately following a lengthy discussion that he asked the attorneys for. He said, I want you to argue for me principle in the second degree and how it applies in this case, and does it apply? And then the Commonwealth attorney and myself spent lengthy time going back and forth arguing principle in the second degree. And following that immediately, does he make his ruling, for one. And the words that the judge used are very on point. Immediately following, I'm on page 208-209, Your Honors. On the bottom of 209, I immediately finish my argument against concert of action. The judge says, all right, Mr. Bouchard, thank you. He then proceeds on line 9 of 210. I do find the defendant was acting in concert of action with the others who were standing around him. By applying that, if he believed that he was a principal in the first degree, he would not have used those words and asked for that argument and base his conclusion on concert of action. Concert of action, as you well know, is an element of principal in the second degree. It defies logic that he would apply those words following that argument if that was not what he was applying. But he did not, as Your Honor, I believe, is pointing out, use the words principle in the second degree. I will concede that point. But going back to the application of principle in the second degree, the principle in the second degree doctrine is a very old doctrine, and it goes back to the classic situation of a bank robber and the getaway driver. And I thought it was very interesting that the attorney for the Commonwealth, in his brief, applied this. But when citing the rule, left out a very important part, and I'm citing the Spradlin case, I believe I'm pronouncing that right. A principal in the second degree is one, not the perpetrator, but present, aiding and abetting the act done or keeping watch or guard at some convenient distance. It seems like in the case law, as they've gone on through time, they've dropped off its initial application. It's the getaway driver. Two other men go in with a gun, rob a bank. He's responsible for the probable consequences of two men going in. If they shoot the clerk, he's charged with murder. It makes sense. The point in this case is, does this set of facts distinguish itself from Johnson? In Johnson, you have a man, the victim, engaging a group, a gang group, that are already affiliated of one mind. He has an altercation with the defendant, verbal, I believe. He goes outside. That same group then pursues him, and the defendant ambushes him from behind and stands there meekly while the rest of his gang, his already unified group, attack him. That is not what happened in this case. The fact of the matter is there are several key points, and some of these points. Let me just make them.
Counsel, let me advise you, which is fine if you'd like to use them. You've got 2 minutes left.
Yes, ma'am.
If you want to reserve that or if you want to continue your argument.
2 minutes left total, or do I still have my five?
You've got 2 minutes total.
I apologize.
You're well into your rebuttal.
I apologize that I didn't see the small clock there. You'll have to forgive me. I'd like to reserve my 2 minutes. Thank you.
Certainly,
the remaining time.
You may.
Thank you.
Thank you. Perhaps they're not large enough to note.
I'm sorry?
Perhaps the lights are not large enough to note here on the bench.
No, this is simply my first time here, and I didn't see the clock. I'm sorry.
Well, thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Aaron Campbell on behalf of the Commonwealth of Virginia. I'll be very brief. It's to the first assignment of error. We haven't talked about it. It seems to be that maybe counsel may be even conceding that point, that the defendant did actually throw the first punch in this case. We have three witnesses from the Commonwealth who testified that he did indeed throw the first punch, and the trial court made a credibility determination. And, of course, this court is bound by the trial court's credibility determinations. So moving on to the second issue is sufficiency and how do we apply it? Is it principle in the first degree? Is it principle in the second degree? I think either one. As to principle in the first degree, there is testimony that the defendant continued to punch the victim. It was on page 73 of the appendix. This was a teenage daughter.
Counsel, let me interrupt.
Sure.
The injury that he sustained, is that not adequate on the first punch for aggravated malicious wounding?
We certainly have case law that an initial punch can be adequate for aggravated malicious wounding.
With the severity of
it? Yes. Is that
your position? That the first punch is all you needed for the aggravated malicious wounding count?
I think we can make that argument. That's the Burkeen case.
Well, are you making that argument?
Yes, I will say that is an alternative argument. We have other arguments.
If in fact that single punch is enough for aggravated malicious wounding, do we need to get to the second assignment of error?
No, we don't.
I'll let you continue to argue. I'm just trying to see
to work
what
through
your
it.
Thought process is.
Yeah, if I recall this case, I didn't argue this on brief. It wasn't argued below. But I did look at the case law on this. I think it's the Burkeen case from the Supreme Court of Virginia that if a single punch is done with such severity that we can infer aggravated malicious wounding from a single punch. In this case, it was a punch to the head, and the defendant sustained it was basically a sucker punch because it came out of nowhere, and he sustained a broken tooth and continued to have tooth pain at the time of trial. But assuming that the punch is insufficient, I think under the principle of the first degree, there are a couple of facts in this record when viewed in the light most favorable that he continued this attack. We have the testimony that he continued to punch him. Now, I understand that counsel's argument is that during cross that witness recanted. I would dispute that was a recant. I think she said he continued to punch. And then a group swarmed in, and then I lost track of what was going on. I think that's a fair reading of her testimony. We also have the victim's mother who said that the defendant was part of the group that was kicking and punching her son. And, of course, we have the defendant himself saying that the defendant's mother scratched him on the back, so he was a part of the group that was involved in the melee. And we have also the older Miss Harrison, not the mother, but the sister, who testified on page 90 of the appendix that the defendant was part of the group that is punching and kicking. Now, she testified he wasn't kicking, but she never said he wasn't punching. And you have the defendant himself saying, I never punched, I never kicked. Of course, the trial court is free to discard the victim's testimony, and that can be affirmative evidence of his guilt. We also have this testimony that I was just merely trying to break up the fight. Well, that doesn't really square with the evidence that if he was trying to break up the fight, that he would have fled when the police arrived instead of telling the police what happened or offered aid to the victim in this case. As for a concert of action, one more point about whether the trial court made a finding as to concert of action or whether it made a finding that the defendant acted as a principal in the first degree. Opposing counsel pointed to the trial court's words on page 210, but I think he left out another line that the trial court said right after he says that the defendant was acting in concert of action. He says, we have another Commonwealth witness who says they saw him continue to be involved on the assault on the son. And I would take that to be that the trial court did think that this defendant continued and was an active participant in the melee and the beating of the victim. But even if we say that he only threw this one punch, that one punch was not enough for aggravated malicious wounding. I think Judge Frank, I think there's a strong argument that that is sufficient. I think he is still guilty as a principal in the second degree. I would disagree with that. Principal in the second degree always has to be something like a getaway driver. The law is that is the defendant doing something to encourage, to incite, to assist in a crime. And in this case, we would argue that the initial punch is something that is encouraging, inciting, and encouraging the crime of aggravated malicious wounding. This is a case where the victim is coming to the aid of his neighbors and telling this group of individuals that if you want to fight someone, you can fight me. And one of the members of that group throws a punch. I think it is a fair assessment that by throwing that punch, that the natural and probable consequences of that action is a crime of aggravated malicious wounding. This is, as the case law says, a finding of fact. The trial court made, I think you can read it, that the trial court made this finding of fact. It is not plainly wrong. There is evidence to support it. Unless there is any questions, I will sit on my brief and ask that the court affirm.
We have none. Thank you, Mr. Campbell.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. I want to address the last point first because of my time situation. The initial punch does not incite the crowd. That's not what incited the crowd. It was the fact that the victim fell with only one punch. And you wouldn't know this because you weren't in the court and you haven't seen these folks, but my client is smaller than the defendant, than the victim. I'm not abandoning the sufficiency of the evidence argument, but I think its ancillary is not as strong as the inapplication of principle in the second degree, and that's why I focus my time. But I'm not abandoning that. I am reserving that for your judgment, just to note. But the fact of the matter is that he incites the crowd. The crowd was a bunch of onlookers that came over from a basketball court to see what there was a prior situation going on at the house, which is in the facts. The judge found, as a matter of fact, that my client threw the first punch. That was not a problem. The probable consequence is not that a group will swoop in, of which he has no conscious cohesion. The probable consequence is that that man called out a fight. I took up his challenge. We will engage in mutual combat. The fact that he fell, not to put too fine a point on one punch, is what incited the crowd. The probable consequence is that we are either going to fight, one of us is going to win. This is like a backyard school, an after-school brawl. That's what this is equivalent to. It does not have the concert of action at the moment of the initiation of violence. And that's where this is distinguishable from Johnson.
But your bottom line is he was only involved in the initial punch and nothing else.
Yes, Your Honor. And if I may, I'm out of time, but may I answer that question more completely?
You certainly may.
The fact that Judge Farmer, and this is another abuse of his discretion, by applying the initial statement of that Commonwealth witness that the attorney mentioned, but ignoring what I was able to get out of that witness on cross, I cast doubt on that witness very clearly. I had her admit you saw a punch, you saw a crowd swoop in, and then you left. You could not tell if the defendant threw any more punches or kicks. Thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, counsel.